The following episode contains mature content. Parental discretion is advised for any listeners under the age of 18.
I'm a radio kid. I grew up before there was TV.
This is a test.
Out past the horizon.
Hello.
People say that you have great self-discipline and that you never let a day go by without working. At what time do you start?
I'm always in a hurry to get going, though in general I dislike starting the day. I first have tea and then at about 10 o'clock I get underway and work until 1. Then I see my friends and after that at 5 o'clock I go back to work and continue until 9. I have no difficulty in picking up the thread in the afternoon. When you leave, I'll read the paper or perhaps go shopping. Most often, it's a pleasure to work.
In The Blood of Others and All Men Are Mortal, you deal with the problem of time. Were you influenced in this respect by Joyce or Faulkner?
No, it was a personal preoccupation. I've always been keenly aware of the passing of time. I always thought that I was old, even when I was 12. I thought it was awful to be 30. I felt that something was lost. At the same time, I was aware of what I could gain, and certain periods of my life have taught me a great deal. But in spite of everything, I've always been haunted by the passing of time and by the fact that death keeps closing in on us. For me, the problem of time is linked up with that of death, with the thought that we inevitably draw closer and closer to it, with the horror of decay. It's that, rather than the fact that things disintegrate, that love peters out. That's horrible too, though I personally have never been troubled by it. There's always been great continuity in my life. I've always lived in Paris, more or less in the same neighborhoods. My relationship with Sartre has lasted a very long time. I have very old friends whom I continue to see. So it's not that I felt that time breaks things up, but rather the fact that I always take my bearings. I mean, the fact that I have so many years behind me, so many years ahead of me, I count them.
Beginning.
Perhaps we were substitutes for each other.
I am trying to find out who I am, who we are.
Okay, that's fine. Then we'll just keep on talking away.
Merrily, 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 merrily. Life is but a dream.
I know how I would listen.
I'm not the least bit concerned about whether my work is likely to last. I've always been aware that the ordinary things of life disappear.
If you ask me later what happened, I'll tell you everything. Nothing.
The Paris Review Podcast, Episode 17, Odd Planets. Featuring excerpts from our Art of Fiction interview with Simone de Beauvoir, reenacted for us by Charlotte Rampling. An essay from Sarah Manguzzo, read by the author. A poem by W.S. Merwin. A short story by Henry Green, read for us by Griffin Dunn. And we begin with a poem by Dinez Smith.
I, like many people, grew up in a house that was loving and complicated. And so, you know, bitch was something that the women in my family and myself, when I postured as them, that was flung at us, you know? And I think bitch in men's mouths always felt like some type of sentencing. There was never a time when bitch was used in a way towards me by women and femme folks that I felt in danger. You know, the bitch is this thing that is never, it's never a weapon in their mouths, you know? And sometimes it's to rein me in, sometimes it's to celebrate me and lift me up, you know, sometimes it dots the sentences, you know? So it peppers the language, you know? Bitch is, to me, the language of friendship. And when I parent myself, it's Dinez. And when I'm friending myself, it's bitch. Get to it. My Bitch, a poem by Dinez Smith. After Nicole Seeley. Oh, bitch. My good bitch. Bitch, my heart. Dream, bitch. Bitch, my solve. Bitch, my order. Bitch, my willow stream. Bitch, my legend. Bitch, like a door. Your name means open in the language of my getting by. Bitch, sesame. Let's get together and paint our faces the color of our mothers. If our mothers were sad men, only soft in bad lights. Let's swirl the deep grape and coffee pencils until we look like odd planets on our way to looking like the daughters we secretly were. Caked and cakes hairy, just short of grace. We look terrible when we're the most beautiful girls in the world. Bitch, my world. Bitch, my brother. Bitch, my rich trust. I'll miss you most when they kill us.
Oceans, an essay by Sarah Manguso. I used to be interested in mountains. They moved at a speed I could deal with. They waited for me to catch up. It was like that all my life. Then we moved to California, and after 8 years of earthquakes, I began to doubt my ability to put things in order. I began to distrust the very idea of order. The mountains were no longer guiding me. The ocean churns and changes and is never still. It's formless, but not timeless. It used to cover the mountains of Utah, and now it doesn't. Just the other day, East Island in the French frigate Shoals was erased. The ocean is like mountains, just much faster. The ocean's form is mutable, and its volume is increasing, its movement increasingly violent. The biggest thing in the world is getting bigger. Recently, I gave a lecture about the importance of repressing the intellect and of wandering. It's about my quitting training to be a pianist, escaping that culture of perfection, and deciding to let something into my life that was non-deliberate. I wasn't really in control back when I was a pianist. I submitted to my mother and to the bullies at school who smelled the fumes of my home life on me. Back then, the piano was necessary because it allowed me to demonstrate at will that I was capable of demonstrating something at will. This lecture was all about my proud discovery that in order to write well, in order to make anything of quality, I had to give the authority over my work to the work itself, the form itself. I'd had to maintain a dynamic balance between will and surrender. The whole lecture was about why to do that, how others said they did it, and how I did it. I was on my way to give this lecture, having found earlier this year that I'd become unable to maintain that balance. I was always either locked down and incapable of producing anything, or at sea, directionless and bored. Also, earlier this year, I was diagnosed with adenocarcinoma in situ. After the requisite biopsies, I had an excision surgery. The resection wasn't big enough. I need to have 4 organs removed. The pathology of cancer, of course, is that it starts out particular and unchecked, grows oceanic. If it finds its way into the right glands, then it goes everywhere, out past the horizon. Soon after the first surgery, I dreamed I had a tattoo. 2 thin blue lines encircling my right forearm. I didn't know what the lines were, but a few months later, I saw that they contain the ocean. Above them is the sky, below them is the sand. It seemed like the easiest tattoo in the world. But then I learned that drawing 2 straight, parallel, encircling lines around a limb is difficult. This fact pleased me, as it had pleased me to perform Mozart, whose music my piano teacher constantly reminded me sounded deceptively simple, but was so difficult that, per the old saying, only the very young and the very old could do it. The urge is to overuse the damper pedal so that the end of one phrase blurs into the beginning of the next. And there I was, in the 20th century, playing Mozart and proudly showing off my moderately decent ability to perform this simple, difficult work. The ocean goes around the world and joins itself. World without end. Amen. Any old song sung in the round can go on forever, too. The first one that American children learn takes place in moving water, or in a dream, or possibly in death, but a living death. Row, row, row your boat gently down the stream. Merrily, 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 life is but a dream. Letting in something non-deliberate means letting in something a little wild and untamed, something that seems alive. During a visit to the University of Malta for American Culture Week, a student led me around the churches of Valletta. "That one is a miracle Christ," she said matter-of-factly, pointing up at a sculpture of her Savior. "A what?" She smiled at my failure to grasp what any Maltese teenager would have understood. She explained that the artist had worried he would be unable to carve the face, so he left it until the very end. He stayed up late, fell asleep in the church, and woke the next morning to find the face had been carved. He had forgotten everything. I miss being able to forget everything. I have a child. My life consists of keeping a trillion details in my head, and I get most of them right, but not every day enough of them, and I then have to deal with my fuck-ups with the child right there next to me, learning what happens when something gets in that's not deliberate. It's the trillion details that have gotten in the way of that non-deliberate thing, I think. It's hard to demarcate an area in which the trillion aren't allowed. Maybe this is another function of the tattoo that I haven't gotten yet. The tracing out of an area in which I'm unaccompanied by the trillion. Cancer mimics life, growing by itself. Or is it alive? It has cells, but it is parasitic. It isn't an organism. You can't isolate it and put it on a leash and walk it around. Have you met my new cancer? My oncologist wants to trace around the area in which any cancer might possibly be growing to contain the form of it before it goes oceanic. I can't get my tattoo until after this second surgery because the skin around the tattoo, in the crook of my elbow, would have to be taped to hold an intravenous line in place. The tattoo artist is fastidious. She won't make the lines until I have 8 weeks to let them heal. I fell into a swimming pool when I was very young. I remember being under the surface, looking up, bright turquoise all around me. I felt disembodied down there. And I saw the blue above me as if it were a sky. I don't remember anything that my body felt, just the blue on top. As if I were supine, under the water, facing up and toward the ledge I'd slipped from. But I don't know how I'd have gone supine from sitting there, and that's why I think of this as an out-of-body experience. I wasn't aware of my body, just what I could see. And what I could see was geometrically improbable. Then I was out of the water, coughing. Someone had lifted me out, but I don't remember that. I just remember the luminous blue all around me and above me, and then, with no connecting memory, as if I'd suddenly woken up, sitting on the concrete lip of the pool and coughing. Still water, no matter how broad or deep, doesn't scare me. But moving water, tidal water, oceanic water, which moves as if alive, as if it has intention, as if it possesses will, is different. I can swim across any lake of reasonable size, but I'm afraid of the ocean. It makes sense to me to place someone in it, an immortal under the water, like the Aztec Chalchutlicue, goddess of water, lakes, rivers, seas, streams, horizontal waters, storms, and baptism. Or the Chinese dragon king of the four seas. Or Nun, the uncreated Egyptian god, personification of the primordial waters. Or the Inuit Nutaikok, a spirit who inhabits icebergs. Or the Mesopotamian Tiamat, goddess of salt water and chaos and mother of all gods. In the recurring nightmare I've dreamed since childhood, I'm swimming in the ocean when a huge wave comes. I forcefully exhale through my nose to keep the water out until I can't exhale anymore. My lungs burning, I give up and breathe in the water. As I inhale, I wake up, alive. The instinct is to end it all. Not to prevent further trouble, but to escape a life in which perfection is no longer possible. I didn't want to bear another child, but I still didn't want to give up that authority to the cancer. Its waves capable of dragging me under the surface of actual life, not merely a nightmare. Just before I fall asleep for surgery, I imagine my foot on the accelerator, and I rush through time, and then I wake up, having sped through part of it. If you ask me later what happened, I'll tell you everything. Nothing. I lived in the Northeast for more than 30 years. Now, in California, almost a decade. Every October, my body anticipates an autumn that never comes. The basic ignorance and stupidity of the body. Yet, the wisdom of it. We moved when I was 13 years old. On the first night, we slept in our new house, the second house I'd ever lived in. I woke up in the middle of the night, disoriented, lying sideways across my narrow bed. My head was pointing north, the direction it had pointed in the old house, in my old room. I've moved houses more than 20 times since, but that never happened again. My son is almost 7 years old. I am no longer the entire background of his life. Now I am just one mountain in it. I haven't told my son that I might have cancer. I think I can keep secrets, but children know things without having to be told. And so I hide the truth, and so the mountain reveals. In our last house, we could see a tiny blue smudge between two trees at sunny midday, after the marine layer had burned off. The ocean. It was a mile away. That was the best place we ever lived. Then the landlord died, and his children sold the house, and we moved again. My parents had measles and scarlet fever, but I didn't. And my son won't have the papillomavirus, but I did. When I was 21, I developed a chronic autoimmune disorder that was rare and hard to explain and even hard to say. Whenever I told anyone the name of it, my first instinct was either to apologize for having made them listen to so many syllables or to immediately explain that it wasn't as bad as the name made it sound. There's such an allure now to naming what's newly wrong with me. I don't have to explain cancer. A decade or so ago, my gynecologist asked me whether I used protection when I had sex. I counted the men I'd had unprotected sex with that year and divided by two. On one hand, I did it because I was immortal, unbreakable, because I'd come relatively unscathed out of something that might have killed me. So unprotected sex was my just reward. On the other hand, I should already have died in my 20s, but Western medicine had saved me, and I was trying to correct the course. My life has changed since then. Now I want to stay here for my son for as long as he needs me. My husband's mother died when he was 40, but he still needs her. When you stand in the wave zone, waves can knock you around easily. Diving under the waves will keep you away from the messy white water and keep you in control, narrates the coach in an online instructional video. The messy white water. The messy white water that precedes the good, knowable physical force of the waves. Before the second surgery, the cancer is speculative. Women cut out parts of themselves to be rid of that speculation. Breasts, uteri, ovaries, tubes, cervices, all kinds of glands. A surgeon friend describes surgery as just intense, meticulous grooming. That we, being primates, groom socially, get the surfaces of our bodies scrubbed, and shaved and cleaned by one another, So going into the body to clean it of something that shouldn't be there, which might be there but is not even exactly visible, is simply an act of grooming a bit further along on the continuum toward complete prophylactic self-removal. I am not interested in depictions of the actual ocean. I don't want to look at beautiful pictures of it. I'm not interested in beauty. I'm interested in the ways that people deal with the ocean. I am interested in forms that are so large, you can't see the boundaries, so you just have to believe in them. They demand faith. I'm interested in people for whom that faith is a problem. When I was 16, I had an internship at a local hospital that included 2 days in histology. The histologist didn't know quite how to teach a high school student about medicine, so he took a bin of uteri out of a refrigerator and handed me one. It was so much smaller than I'd expected, like a small yellow onion or a withered pear, but it was rubbery like charcuterie, not like a pear at all. I remember how that uterus felt in my hand. Maybe it wasn't even the surgery that made me need that tattoo. Maybe it was just that we moved out of the old house, and I refused to give up my view. Well, I'm never going to lose that view now. My husband also wants a tattoo. He wants the dates of his mother's and father's lives on his body, which has to have something to do with the fact that he hates cemeteries. Now he wants to become a gravestone, even though he threw his parents' ashes into the ocean. I was sad when I left that first house, too. I was sad. The wisdom of my body turned me sideways in bed in the new house. It's counterintuitive to run toward the terrible thing, to dive under the wave, to let it get on top of you where it might master you. But that's the entire job. After my adenocarcinoma was found, my husband ran toward it. He didn't do it with me. He did it for me. The week before the surgery, I stopped thinking about it. I could feel myself tracing a large form around myself, inside which no cancer was allowed. I walked around all week surrounded by this clean bubble of air and light. Sometimes there are so many thousands of tiny clamshells on the beach that they accumulate into drifts. One day, my son and I picked up pairs of shells, still connected, in every color of the rainbow, including pale pink and bright blue. Then the tide turned, and by the next morning, the drifts were gone. Now it's the night before the surgery. I don't feel afraid, but my back hurts so much I can't move. I'm a mountain, immovable. I never considered that the mountains might move faster if it didn't hurt so much. I've had 8 surgeries and was always glad to fall asleep and wake up done with being cut. But this time, I cried all the way from pre-op into the operating room. "I don't know why I'm crying," I said. "I still don't." It's as if I saw into the future, in which I had a tattoo, and now I have to get it, to catch up with reality, to add something to my body that won't change. Damage, growth, and time are all the same thing to a body. Thank you.
Break, a reenactment from the Paris Review interview with Simone de Beauvoir, played by Charlotte Rampling, a short story by Henry Green, and a poem by W.S. Merwin, when the Paris Review podcast continues.
In your memoirs, you draw a portrait of Sartre at the time he was writing Nausea. You picture him as being obsessed by what he calls his crabs, by anguish. You seem to have been, at the time, the joyous member of the couple. Yet, in your novels, you reveal a preoccupation of death that we never find in Sartre.
In a way, Sartre thought he was immortal. He had staked everything on his literary work and on the hope that his work would survive. Whereas for me, owing to the fact that my personal life will disappear, I'm not the least bit concerned about whether my work is likely to last. I've always been aware that the ordinary things of life disappear. One's day-to-day activities, one's impressions, one's past experiences. Sartre thought that life could be caught in a trap of words, and I've always felt that words weren't life itself, but a reproduction of life, of something dead, so to speak.
In every one of your novels, we find a female character who is misled by false notions and who is threatened by madness.
Lots of modern women are like that. Women are obliged to play at being what they aren't. To play, for example, at being great courtesans, to fake their personalities. They're on the brink of neurosis. I feel very sympathetic towards women of that type. They interest me more than the well-balanced housewife or mother. There are, of course, women who interest me even more. Those who are both true and independent, who work and create.
None of your female characters are immune from love. You like the romantic element.
Love is a great privilege. Real love, which is very rare, enriches the lives of men and women who experience it.
In your novels, it seems to be the women, I'm thinking of Françoise and She Came to Stay and Anne and the Mandarins, who experience it most.
The reason is that, despite everything, women give more of themselves in love because most of them don't have much else to absorb them. Perhaps they're also more capable of deep sympathy, which is the basis of love.
This is a test.
It's Saturday afternoon at the edge of the world.
Where are you? I wanted to say.
White pages lift in the wind and fall.
The human animal is subject to attrition.
To love another is something like prayer and can't be planned.
Bitch, get to it.
Arcady, or A Night Out, by Henry Green. We were in the car, swinging through the traffic, and the air inside drooped with folded wings at the shut windows and the scent she used. Sweeping through the streets that swirled in eddies of changing light, talking nervously, she and I, of what was coming. Then down into the dirty brick of Swallow Road, and the chauffeur of her proud car, incredulous at first, then anxious for her safety, yet not so anxious as she was. Up the stairs and in through the glass door, and her involuntary cry of, "Henry!" For she was nervous, while the chauffeur thought dark things of me below, and my voice reassuring her. At our table, groping through the names of Spanish dishes, wrestling with the faulty English of our waiter. She saw someone she did not wish to see, and was it because my reputation had outdistanced me? Then our modest half-bottle of some Spanish wine and her account of how she took Wingaris as a tonic and how her daily dose inebriated her, of my fears that our waiter and myself should have to carry her down the stairs to the proud car and the chauffeur's face when he saw what had been done, of my trip to Africa to give society leisure to forget. Perhaps we were substitutes for each other, so that her young man was not myself, but someone else who in her imagination was toying with a Spanish omelet in my place, while I began to know that it was not her at any rate whom I would have sitting opposite me, but someone else perhaps. The bill paid, and in the car again with no mishap, thrusting on to the theater, and my fears, for it was a music hall at her request, and the jokes there might prove difficult to face. The program seller had a face of enameled paint, a man and a woman on the stage singing of love in a back garden under a flowering tree. Hysterical laughter when the curtain came down to cover the emptiness that was left. She saw more people she knew, and they looked anxiously at me. Then a scene with a bed upon a stage with the tumult of my fears storming within me. More laughter when the curtain fell. Next, the chorus dancing with gnarled legs and waving in boneless arms in harsh mauve and carmine lights, and so on to the end. Then sentiment in a taxi, for the chauffeur had gone outraged to bed with his proud car. How we never met. How this must be repeated. What an adventure it was. What fun it had been. And adventure it was. For we had deputized for each other's dream.
Tries to be and, in the long run, merely exists. It's because of this discrepancy that when you turn around and look back on your life, you see that you've simply existed. In other words, life isn't behind you like a solid thing, like the life of a god, as it is conceived, that is, as something impossible. Your life is simply a human life.
The night singing. Long after Ovid's story of Philomela has gone out of fashion, and after the testimonials of Hafiz and Keats have been smothered in comment and droned dead in schools, and after Eliot has gone home from the Sacred Heart, and Ransom has spat and consigned to human youth what he reduced to fairy numbers, after the name has become slightly embarrassing and dried skins have yielded their details and tapes have been slowed and analyzed and there is nothing at all for me to say, one nightingale is singing nearby in the oaks where I can see nothing but darkness and can only listen and ride out on the long note's invisible beam that wells up and bursts from its unknown star, on, on, never returning, never the same, never caught, while through the small leaves of May the starlight glitters from its own journeys. Once in the ancestry of this song my mother visited here, lightning struck the locomotive in the mountains. It had never happened before, and there were so many things to tell that she had just seen and would never have imagined. Now afield away I hear another voice beginning, and on the slope there is a third, not echoing, but varying. After the lives, after the goodbyes, after the faces and the light, after the recognitions and the touching and tears, those voices go on rising. If I knew, I would hear in the last dark that singing. I know how I would listen.
That concludes the Paris Review Podcast, Episode 17, Odd Planets. The pieces that you heard in this episode are excerpts of our Art of Fiction interview with Simone de Beauvoir, which appeared in the Paris Review issue 34, Spring 1965. It was reenacted for us by the incredible
Charlotte Rempling,
with the part of the interviewer played by our very own
Ryan Sassine.
My Bitch, a poem written and read for us by
Dinesh Smith.
It also appeared in issue 228, Spring 2019. We had editing assistance on this piece from Bri Moore. Oceans, an essay written and read for us by the author
Sarah Manguso.
It appeared in issue 228, Spring 2019. Arcady, or A Night Out, fiction by Henry Green, which appeared in issue 123, Summer 1992. It was read for us by
Griffin Dunn.
Plus a reading of Night Singing, a poem by W.S. Merwin, which first appeared in issue 128, Fall 1993. Special thanks to the Library of Congress and to the Poetry Foundation for this recording. Go to poetryfoundation.org for more. This podcast is a co-production of the Paris Review and Stitcher. Our production team includes
John Delore,
Brendan Francis Noonan of Public Address Media,
Helena de Groot,
Craig Morgan Teicher,
Lori Dorr,
and me, Emily Nemmons. Our advisory board members are Ijeoma Azoto, Alexander Chi, Glory Edom, Haley Gates, and Tony Ann Fernandez. We had production assistance from Ashley Warren. Special thanks to Daisy Rosario and Chris Bannon, the Chief Content Officer at Stitcher, and everyone over at TPR HQ. This episode was mixed and sound designed by John Delore, Helena de Groot, and Andy Christensdottir, featuring original music composed and performed by a talented ensemble that includes David Sieri, Emily Wells, Mike Brown, Sam Ospavat, Rob Schwimmer, Shahzad Ismaili, and Casey Holford. Our theme song is composed by David Sieri. A very special thanks to Hendrix Gin, the presenting sponsor of Season 2 of the Paris Review Podcast. Oddly infused with rose and cucumber, Hendrix Gin. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast, and while you're at it, please leave us a review. And if you want to read any of the pieces in this episode, subscribe at theparisreview.org. You'll get access to our 66-year digital archive, new essays on the Paris Review Daily, and the very best in new poetry, fiction, art, and interviews. A beautiful journal delivered straight to your door 4 times a year. Thanks for listening. Wait.
This tape represents a majority of the questions and answers for the Paris Review interview, but there are others which will be sent along post-haste. Thanks.
Stitcher.